Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Hello, and welcome to the 6th episode of The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Laura.
And...
Ben.
Yay, Ben's back.
Woohoo!
In today's episode, we are covering the film Gravity. We have an interview with Chris Hadfield of the International Space Station and Canadian Space Agency. And we've had a very special guest visiting the shed, Hattie Briggs, folk singer, incredible voice, incredible songwriting talent. As always, there will be spoilers. If you haven't seen Gravity yet...
What are you doing?
Exactly. What on earth are you doing? If you have seen it, go and watch it again. And then again, and then again. Just keep watching it.
It's only 90 minutes long.
Yeah, just come round to our house. We'll watch it. It's fine. We don't all share the same house. But anyway.
We're just like the monkeys.
We actually live in the shed.
Don't tell them. Before we go any further, I should actually say that the competition for the Apollo 13 episode has been won.
Yes, the never-ending competition has ended.
So, Steve Bullock... One, he's got 3 bags of Slow Brew Club coffee. But we do have a new competition running now.
Much easier competition.
Yeah, it is considerably easier. Have a listen to the bonus episode all about the Sci-Fi Weekender, and you'll find the details there. But you can win the very first Cosmic Shed t-shirt.
Wow.
I know, pretty amazing. The film Gravity.
Directed by?
Alfonso Cuarón.
Written by?
Alfonso Cuarón and Jonas Cuarón.
And the cast.
Sandra Bullock plays.
Ryan Stone.
George Clooney plays.
Matt Kowalski.
Ed Harris as.
The voice of Mission Control, as in Apollo 13.
And the music.
Stephen Price.
Why are we covering it now, Ben?
We thought we could wait to the 5-year anniversary, the 10-year, the 20-year, like we did with Apollo 13. But the shed might not be standing at that point, so we really wanted to look at Gravity because it was one of the films that inspired us to make this podcast. The mix of real science and artistic license, science fiction that is kind of grounded in authentic technology, authentic science.
The other reason is that we had a bit of the interview with Chris Hadfield in our 3rd episode about Apollo 13, and we've got some of it left. We needed somewhere to put it, and Gravity seemed the perfect excuse. Before we go any further...
Yeah.
Ben, have you done a poem?
I've made a poem for this episode. It was a tough one trying to find a form that fitted with Gravity. We were thinking about the themes of rebirth, letting go. In the end, Andrew has asked me to make a concrete poem for this episode.
Was that not quite expensive?
Well, that's why I had so much trouble lifting it, like getting it to the house, chipping away at it all. Yeah. Concrete poem is a form of poetry where the shape is as important as the words. So originally, Andrew asked me to make a concrete poem in the shape of the International Space Station, which of course would be very fitting. The ISS features in Gravity, Chris Hadfield, second home.
Unfortunately, Ben bottled it.
Yeah, I decided the ISS was way too complicated. So instead, I went for the Soyuz, which is...
The Soyuz is a Russian spacecraft, which takes people to and from space.
And of course, heavily featured in Gravity as a lifeboat. So the concrete poem in the shape of the Soyuz, we'll put it up on the website. But the poem goes something like this. A question I often get. Are you jealous? Well, no, not really. Sure, she's shiny and stunning and sleek. She always got all the attention and the applause, while I flew under the radar, looking inelegant, utilitarian, plain. but I've been doing this since the 60s, and I'm still going strong. And who do they get to come and save the day? Not her, all glamour and perfect curves, but little old me. Not turning any heads, just getting the job done.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
I saw a picture of the script the other day, the original script, and it said on the original script, Gravity, a space suspense in 3D. So they kind of set out their stall early on, and that's exactly what it is.
They didn't disappoint, did they?
It's from the moment Ed Harris crops up on the radio, it's just a roller coaster that finally lets you off at the end. We're going to use that word roller coaster a lot in this episode.
I first saw Gravity. I was very lucky, not to brag. Yeah, I'm bragging a bit. My first experience of watching Gravity was in a 4DX cinema in Busan, South Korea. 4DX means there are four dimensions. Somehow.
Can we discuss the final dimension?
Are we going back to Interstellar now?
Yeah. Oh, I wish I'd seen Interstellar in 4DX. That would be great.
Incredible. Floating outside the cinema, looking down
into your...
As all the seats move. Oh, incredible.
As a big fan of Alfonso Cuarón's previous film, particularly I'm thinking of Children of Men, modern sci-fi classic, some absolutely breathtaking sequences, long takes. Yeah, I was really excited about this film. I was in South Korea. And it came out, I think it came out a little bit before the UK. I'd done a sort of trailer blackout, information blackout. So I came to it as sort of fresh as I could.
Good work.
4DX is an experience. The chairs rock with the film. There's bass coming from under the chair. When at appropriate moments, air is blown into your face. In some films, there's water which squirts out of the chair in front of you. And Gravity was my first experience with that. And I think the perfect film for that 4DX experience. So I was absolutely blown away. I wanted to go back and see, is this actually a great film as well? I saw it in 2D in the cinema. Still had a very similar experience. Absolutely loved it the second time around. Probably one of my favourite cinematic experiences. As a kind of argument for why cinema is still important as a collective experience, there's very few films that I kind of rate higher than Gravity.
Mm. You said you're bragging, and you are, but fair enough.
Yeah, rightly so.
It seems like a gimmick, the whole 4DX thing, and it is.
Yeah, of course.
But for this particular film, it worked perfectly.
Yeah, a bit like 3D in that way, which is how I saw it in IMAX 3D. I heard Chris Hadfield say that visually, Gravity was better than any space movie ever made, and it was just like being out on a spacewalk. And that is all I knew about the film before I went to see it. So I thought, I'll go and see it in IMAX 3D, and that is as close as I'm going to get. The first time I saw it was in IMAX 3D. The second time I saw it was in IMAX 3D. And the third time I saw it was in IMAX 3D. Because I just kept going back to the cinema. Because it's amazing. It's so beautiful. Despite it only being in three dimensions, I mean, what a load of rubbish. Despite it only being...
You could have asked a friend to blow air at you at a critical moment. Yeah.
This podcast will now be in four dimensions.
So despite it only being in three dimensions, I was gripping my seat. Just the tensest experience I've had in the cinema ever. When I was a teenager, we went to Disneyland or World, whichever one's got Space Mountain in it. Space Mountain is a roller coaster based in space. And you go into the dark. Me and my brother went on Space Mountain, I think something like 17 or 18 times over the day that we were there. We just kept going back on it. And I think that's what's going to happen with Gravity. I'm just going to keep going back to it, like a small child on a roller coaster. I was slightly hesitant about watching it again, not on such a big screen and not in 3D. But I did when...
Well, embarrassingly enough, I had not seen it until a couple of weeks ago. I've had a few tellings off, actually, rather than having not seen it by several family members, friends, and, of course, members of the shed as well. So I was told that it was...
Sorry.
I had high expectations for it. And I saw it on a projector screen, and it didn't disappoint whatsoever.
I would ask you, Laura, what your first reactions were, but we put you on the spot and recorded you straight afterwards.
So Ben and Andrew weren't joking. That was just the most amazing film. And the most stressful film I think I've ever watched. She really wasn't having a good day, was she? It's so realistic. That's just how I would imagine space to be. Absolutely terrifying, yet absolutely beautiful at the same time. And the vast shots over the whole screen of Earth. That was just absolutely beautiful. I think that made the film.
I have to say, it didn't at all lose any of its impact, showing it on a much smaller than IMAX screen in our house. Just an incredibly impactful film. Just
we will be screening it in the Cosmic Shed in the future.
We have to.
It feels like something completely modern and of now. You know, this could only really have been achieved with the technology we've got now. Obviously, the effects are incredible. The way they managed to create a seemingly completely authentic version of space, the lighting, the different stages of the Earth that they go through, and the movement, the kind of weight of it all is fantastic. The belief that they could pull that off.
Yeah.
And that at this moment, obviously they invented quite a lot of technology. A lot of it was experimental technology for this film, but the technology is there. Mm. The CGI and the practical effects that they use is there to support this vision.
Yeah.
It's kind of... At
the moment, I don't know that they knew that, though, when they started.
Well, the belief that it could be done.
Right. That's brilliant to have that belief, because there's no way... Because I've seen that film as many times as I have, not until we watched the extras, that I realised that they weren't actually using actual footage from the International Space Station of Earth. Because it's, you know, I don't know how they knew that they could do that, or how they believed it. Yeah. Hats off to them for doing it.
Well, it took a long time. It took... Yeah. We talked about Big Hero 6. Animated films take usually at least four years through the whole production. This film was very similar. It had, five years. In a lot of ways, it's an animated film. Almost all the action you see, there have been real models and real sets built for the actors to interact with, but most of what you see, right down to the spacesuits, is CGI. There's very few sequences when they're inside the capsules or the space stations where you do see their bodies, but when you see the spacesuit, basically the whole of that is CGI.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it's a wonderful achievement in terms of CG, but at the same time, it's more than that. It feels so authentic. Yeah. The sound, the way that you sound, the vibration, the music, the way that the music ties in with the vibration, the sound effects. Of course, sound is all vibration, but in this film, it's particularly true that all you hear is the kind of clangs and bangs coming through George and Sandra's suits.
Yeah.
And you really feel that on the soundtrack.
Oh, it's amazing. Can we go watch it again now?
Yeah.
I think we should.
I really love the lighting and the colours, especially the scene when the ISS is being horrifyingly ripped to shreds by the debris.
It's a really sensitive subject, I think, Andrew's. It needs a moment.
Oh, no, it's terrifying. It's terrifying and really, yeah, it is shocking. Within that destruction, there's so many little narratives going on.
Yeah. It completely, every time, rips my heart out seeing that.
Yeah.
I was like, even if that's a model, you can't do that! even in CGI, you can't do it because it's heartbreaking. But absolutely brilliant.
The push in when as she's sort of drifting for the first time, and it sort of spinning and spinning.
Yeah.
And you're just in, and it just stays with her at that point, and then pushes into a helmet, and you kind of get her viewpoint, and the breathing and the reflections on her helmet.
Yeah.
And you're there. And definitely in the early sequences, the first take, probably about 15 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't let you go. At first, it's just very... The camera's drifting around. It's very... You know, you feel the camera as a physical kind of presence, sort of looking around. And then from the point of view where the debris starts to hit, then you're kind of wheeling around with Sandra and George. But then it stays. You know, it doesn't cut at any point. So you're in there. You can't escape from that world. And that, I think that... It can be overused, long takes, but when it's done right, as I think it is in this case, it really immerses you into that action. And, I mean, the kind of planning required for those shots, I mean, that's where the years went, is working out all the... how exactly to keep everything in shot and the best places to cut. And that's, again, great choices in editing and yeah. in direction, when to kind of cut and let you take a breath or show the kind of scale of the predicament they're in. Later on, there are more cuts and it's more conventional, but those long takes in the beginning particularly really establish where you are, the sort of physical reality of the world, or space, rather. I felt like it was something genuinely different in a blockbuster in terms of the storytelling. It's 90 minutes, it's a really lean film, but it feels like 15 minutes. You're just kind of flying through it. It never, pretty much never lets up. They could have easily made this a 2-hour film, which had sections on Earth of them going up. They could have had other characters. They could have had an antagonist. Could have been extended. It could have had lots of flashbacks. Instead, they chose to keep it not real time. Probably takes place over around 4 hours, maybe, if we yeah. kind of time it out. The debris cloud hits them every 90 minutes. They make a point of that in the film. But almost real time to really just focus on, it's a problem-solving narrative. It's how do they get out of this problem? It's all so direct. Kind of reading about it later, that was their focus. They started from the point of, yeah, for our next film, we want to make something really lean, a 90-minute thriller suspense movie.
They had that idea of a sort of a 90-minute suspense thriller. They got that vision of an astronaut drifting off into space, and it sort of grew from there, those two things put together.
Yeah.
With the idea being,
how does that astronaut get there, and yeah. then how does she get out of it?
It shows how good a director he is. It's basically set in one scene, isn't it? Or two scenes, the whole film. You know when you go to the theatre and there's a chair sitting in the middle of the stage and you think, how good is this play going to be? They've just got a chair there. And so at the start of the film, like, this is amazing. Like, the shots are beautiful. And then when you realise that inside the space station and the shot, and that is it for the film, you're like, oh, how good is this going to be? And it hooks you. And I think that's really something quite special.
Yeah.
It hooks you in. So it's just like going to the theatre with that chair, and all of a sudden, for 3 hours, or an hour and a half in this case, you're sitting there on the edge of your seat, gripping it.
I wanted to go to the film and just have astronauts doing a spacewalk for 90 minutes. I'd have been happy with that. And effectively, you kind of get that. If you've ever been to see Hubble 3D on the IMAX in the Science Museum and various other places, which is probably the only film I've seen in an IMAX more than Gravity. What they do differently is they have the astronauts down on Earth first, getting ready to go, talking about the mission, and then they go up on the mission to fix Hubble. So it's very similar. And then you get this amazing 3D realisation from Hubble imagery of a fly-through of the Orion Nebula, and it is breathtakingly gorgeous.
I find myself wanting another film. So I want the backstory to Ryan, and I want to know what happens. I want to know where she landed.
You wanted the 2.5-hour version.
Oh, I did.
The Apollo 13 2.
Yeah, I wanted the version where you had to have a break halfway in between to go get more pick and mix and then come back. Like, I wanted that version. Yeah.
I'll see that too.
That, I think, yeah, it would be interesting, but it would have broken the tension.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's, I mean, that's it. Just seeing Ed Harris in his lovely waistcoat again, which of course we all want to see that again. Mm.
But he's there in your mind, isn't
he? He's there in your mind, and then he's gone, which is a devastating moment.
Mm.
And what does he become?
Houston in the Blind, which is a wonderful line of dialogue. Obviously that's an authentic expression that they would use, but for some reason just the use of that in the film really stuck in my head. It just, and I think there's a lot of really good language, especially in the early part of the film. I think the writing of this film is really underrated. There was a lot of criticism when the film came out, and I've heard this from people I've talked to, that it's a badly written film.
Stop talking to those
people. They are not your real friends.
Mainly because there are a few dialogue scenes which they felt didn't really work. It was too on the nose, the dialogue scene between Sandra Bullock and George Clooney when she's kind of explaining her backstory. They felt that was cheesy and that didn't work. I guess part of the cheesiness of that is that, why wouldn't they know this already? They've trained together, they've worked together. It's very much like a character asking the question the audience needs to know. And possibly they could have found a smoother way to do that.
Mm.
Yeah, I think they get away with it because they're in this incredibly tense situation. He's trying to talk to her about something grounded and solid, that she has a reason to go back to Earth.
Her character is quite a closed book, though. You do wonder that even if they have had conversations on Earth, that she hadn't opened up, she hadn't confided that information.
Absolutely.
In him.
But the writing of this film is the construction of it. Without the script, without a really tightly written script that
propels them from one point to another, this film wouldn't exist. And I think in the initial sequence, where it is just George Clooney puffering around the space shuttle, which I guess was Andrew's favourite part, the happy moment, the happy 5 minutes when they're listening to country music. Yeah. But in that sequence, there's really quite subtle exposition setting up the world and use of some jargon, and I think that sets it up really, really well. Perhaps some of the dialogue is a little bit on the nose, it's simple, you know, it's direct, and that's what this film is. It's a sincere, quite earnest, direct film.
One of the things that I just love so much about the film is that moment when she's back on Earth, and just the vibrancy of life on Earth in comparison to space is just brilliantly done, because you've been in space for the whole film. It is a metaphor. It's a lot of metaphors, but it's one big metaphor as well. That idea of somebody just being so lost in the relentlessness of life's problems just coming back on a cyclical nature. And then the counterpoint of Matt, who is just literally living in the moment, looking at the beauty of the world around him. And there's actually a quote from Chris Hadfield where he says, when you're out there, you're in between the world and the universe. You're not of the world. In fact, you have a sense that you and the world are going through the universe together. I think that's sort of metaphorically what the film is doing. That we, as humans, are hurtling towards death. And if we look at it that way, we give up. But if we live in the moment and experience it as life, then we can get an awful lot out of it.
The directness of the filmmaking is reflected in the themes that they portray. It's very clearly about a sort of rebirth, about Ryan letting go of some of her grief, coming to terms with things, being reborn. There are so many shots which kind of relate to birth, and tethers are such a kind of strong symbol in this film. There are so many shots of, you know, a character kind of on a tether or falling off a tether or grabbing onto a tether. Obviously, the umbilical, that's the symbol. It's a very direct symbol. Statue of the Buddha floating at one point. It's very, very clear that that's what they're going for. But it's effective. It's kind of visceral and something very physical about that imagery. There's kind of nothing accidental in this film.
Everything in the film is just working all the time to support those key themes. The imagery, the editing, the sound,
the music, the way that the music ties in with the vibration, the sound effects,
both the performances, very committed performances, the way the atmosphere is built up, the pretty minimal dialogue, the narrative drive, and the way that everything in the film is conveyed through action, pretty much. You're never stopping for a burst of info. It's all through the action. A film that I saw at a similar time to Gravity, I think actually in the same week, was All Is Lost, which is a really similar story, even more minimal. It's just Robert Redford on a boat in the middle of the sea trying to survive, but a very similar narrative idea, and really worth watching, I think, if you haven't seen All Is Lost. It's a great double bill with Gravity, actually. But I think both of those films, one set in space, one set on the ocean, they kind of do the same thing. All Is Lost has even less kind of backstory, even less dialogue, but they both really anchor you in the present moment with those characters and just don't let you escape, which is a beautiful thing to experience for 90 minutes.
I couldn't look away. The only time I looked away was to look at Andrew to say, why did you make me watch this? I'm so stressed. But I honestly, I was transfixed.
I didn't notice that because I had my head in my hand.
There are moments of kind of reflection. When she first gets into the ISS and floating in that prenatal pose, spinning around.
She's quite a versatile actress, isn't she?
No, she's versatile, but she has, and in a way that Clooney isn't necessarily versatile, but that's not why we watch. No, they're movie stars. Both of them, that was a choice that they made. A film that could be quite inaccessible in some ways. Yeah, having those two actors with such strong presence does add another element to it.
Because I didn't know anything apart from Chris Hadfield saying it was like being in space, and that George Clooney and Sandra Bullock was in it. I was a little bit confused. I was like, what's it going to be? Is it going to be a rom-? And then when George Clooney dies, it's like, really? Because he dies quite early on.
Yeah.
And that's,
I think that's right. It's playing with audience expectations. Yeah. That, like, Clooney doesn't die.
Yeah, in the moment of resolve, I'm ready. It's okay, so am I. Let's do this.
That sequence of the debris kind of flaming down is gorgeous. And it's not Sigur Rós, but it could be at that moment.
That sort of
rush
of
the music.
That would be amazing.
And it's earned it by that point. Yeah. It's over the top, but it really works. Yeah. There are major inaccuracies in the film, but there are a lot of things which are based on real stuff.
Yeah.
For example, the effects of weightlessness are incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was all done with rigs. They didn't go up in the Vomit Comet. All done with rigs and CG, but they had to match the lighting in the sets with what's going to be going on in the background. It doesn't have that green screen feel at all. It's all kind of composited so beautifully. But they're in a microgravity environment.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, it is. Microgravity is, because it's not actually zero gravity. It's just very, very small amount of gravity, so it's microgravity.
And the catalyst for the story, the chain reaction of the debris from satellites.
The Kessler effect.
Ah, there you go.
So the Kessler effect was proposed by NASA scientist Donald Kessler. And effectively what it works out as, if two pieces of space debris collided in space because of the relative speeds that they were going at, they would explode into lots of different pieces, and that would cause a chain reaction. And as happens in the film, lots of pieces of space debris would start colliding into each other, and all these tiny bits would start causing havoc. And it's known as the Kessler effect.
And it's never actually happened.
But they do track the bigger pieces of space debris. All people who launch things into space track them. And if there's a launch in space, they have a window for the launch, and there are bits of it that are blacked out because if they launched at that point, they would collide with a piece of space debris. And the International Space Station is pockmarked, really, by being hit by tiny pieces of space debris. It is actually a real problem.
And becoming more and more serious.
Becoming more and more serious. So we really should stop going into space. No, shouldn't.
Just clean up after ourselves,
exactly.
Like responsible citizens of the universe.
Well, it's like the countryside code.
It is. Well, there is one. You see, it's the satellites and everything that's put in space should be up there and working for 25 years, which is fine. But what happens after 25 years is that they're no longer working, and then they're just space junk. And then it seemed like when they were sending Apollo missions up there on the Saturn V and all those bits came off, that seemed fine. Just a few bits. But now it's like, there's graphics of it. We'll post a link to some pictures of it. There's a graphic of it, a film of it in the Science Museum in London, which really brings it home. But you can see that online as well. We'll post that on the website. The moment when George Clooney opens the hatch and reappears in Sandra Bullock's life. If you believed that had really happened, you might think, but that would have killed her. But no, actually it wouldn't.
Oh, really? I assumed that she would die when that happened.
That's the common belief. But if she'd held her breath, she would have been okay for about 15 seconds.
I feel like the klaxons are going on a QI at the moment.
And we know this because an accident, in inverted commas, happened in 1965 when a technician at NASA was stuck in near vacuum conditions for about 15 seconds. And after 8 seconds, he passed out. And after about 14 seconds, he came round. But when he recovered, the last thing he could remember was the saliva boiling on his tongue. But he survived, so she could have survived. While we're on the subject of scientific accuracy, I wasn't aware that people were complaining about the scientific accuracy of this film until Ben said to me, "Have you seen what Neil deGrasse Tyson's tweeting about gravity?" And I thought, hang on, I haven't, because I follow Neil deGrasse Tyson on Twitter, obviously, of course I do. He's the head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, and he's a science communicator. He has his own talk show called Star Talk, which is also a podcast, which is very good indeed. And he also presents the new version of Cosmos, which was the Carl Sagan series. And all-round good guy, but caused a bit of a storm. He had a string of tweets which he entitled or started Mysteries of Gravity. Complaining about some things in Gravity. Complaining, maybe a bit strong.
But nitpicking.
Nitpicking is the word, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it says in our intro, we don't want to nitpick.
We do sometimes.
Of course we do.
We can't help it, really.
But we don't want to, is the point. We didn't say we're not going to, we said we don't want to.
There you go.
I'm sure Neil deGrasse Tyson doesn't want to either. But I thought it was just worth looking at some of those tweets.
Yeah.
Mysteries of Gravity. Why Bullock's hair, in otherwise convincing zero-G scenes, did not float freely on her head.
Very strong wax.
The response to that, of course, is nitpicking. So, Mysteries of Gravity, how Hubble, 350 miles up, and the International Space Station, 230 miles up, and a Chinese space station are all in sight lines of one another. And the answer to that is because it's a film and not in reality. Yeah. And the film wouldn't have worked if they were not all on the same plane.
And you can easily get around that one by saying it's kind of an alternative reality. The shuttle is still functioning, so in this alternative reality, they're all kind of next to each other in space. Absolutely fine. No one cares about that one.
Mysteries of Gravity. Astronaut Clooney informs medical doctor Bullock what happens medically during oxygen deprivation. And what he's missed off there is incredibly stressed medical doctor Bullock.
Mm. Yeah, that's just misunderstanding a film.
Yes.
Ridiculous.
And the only one that I wholeheartedly agree with, Mysteries of Gravity, why we enjoy a sci-fi film set in make-believe space more than we enjoy actual people in real space. Well said. Neil?
Well, we can enjoy them both equally,
sure. We can, but Hubble 3D doesn't make as much money as Gravity has.
Well, I think you've been to see enough times to keep it afloat.
Yeah, we should point out, to be fair to Neil deGrasse Tyson, that he was joking.
Yes.
And he did tweet that he really enjoyed the film.
And he was having a slow morning.
But other people did have problems with the film.
I think the reason that this film particularly created that kind of nitpicking culture is because it builds up such an authentic portrayal. So many details feel so true, and so many details are spot on, that the things that don't quite follow reality do stand out, especially to people who have more knowledge of it. And there are a bunch of, you know, articles that came out at the time really criticising the film on those levels. Some of those just are nitpicking for the sake of it.
I think it goes back to our first episode about Interstellar, yeah. Doesn't it? It's science fiction, yeah. And if you enjoy it, then why does it matter? And the thing is that most of it is realistic.
And in fairness to a lot of these people, they did enjoy the film. What they're trying to do is science communication by pointing out the scientific errors in it. And that's yeah. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. But I think it's when it's used as a criticism of the film, it's
yeah, it's yes. A totally different thing. Yeah, a totally different thing. One of the best articles at the time that I read was on Ain't It Cool News, a guy who writes under the name Copernicus. It's a very long article, really detailed, about what the film gets right scientifically and what's a little bit off, what they've used as artistic license and what he feels kind of works and doesn't. But at the end of the day, he concludes, it's one of his favourite films, it's one of the most authentic portrayals. So it's from a really positive point of view, but really interesting kind of seeing what is a bit different and where they have maybe gone a little bit further than perhaps they could have. One sequence for me was George Clooney's sacrifice sequence. As the ISS is being destroyed, Ryan and Matt are floating away. She's kind of desperately trying to grab onto the red parachute ropes, grabs hold of one of those ropes and is kind of still moving, and then she grabs onto George Clooney and they're still moving. They have the momentum that's going to keep them going, and there's quite a long dialogue sequence in which George Clooney's character Matt Kowalski explains why he has to let go to save Ryan. They can't both hold on. And I think on the second viewing, I just felt it was something a bit off about that sequence. But I don't think it's actually the science that's wrong. It's more that they don't quite portray what they were going for, which is that there was always movement. They kept moving.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the film, it kind of seems like they've come to a stop, which of course in space means they're fine. They can pull on that rope and go back the way they came. It's almost one of those sequences where time is strung out so that they can have that dialogue that perhaps would have been very, very quick. It still works emotionally. I thought it's great. Mm. But it's just one of those sequences where you think, was there another way? Was there another way of showing this that would have felt a bit more
a bit more earned, a bit more kind of grounded within the reality.
It works perfectly well for me. I don't worry about the science of it. As Alfonso Cuarón says himself, of course there are things that are not accurate, and we knew about them, and we chose to disregard those things because we wanted, first of all, to honour the emotional journey of the film. And for me, from start to finish, works on that level.
When you're watching the film, it's the reality of the film that you're inside. And
yeah.
97% of this film, I'm totally there with these characters. George Clooney's character, you know, it's an idealised version of an astronaut, much like...
me.
Ah, yeah. Someone else, I can't remember. Who else?
Oh, Chris Hadfield. Oh,
much like Chris Hadfield does.
Yes, indeed.
Andrew, as we can tell... You're a big fan of Commander Chris Hadfield.
Yes.
Why do you think he made such an impression on us?
Well, prosaically, I think it's because he and his son managed to catch the wave of social media and Twitter at a really crucial point in time of that.
I was one of those Twitter followers. He didn't pop up on my radar until I found out that somebody was posting from space. And I was like, I have got to see this. I've got to see this. And I think... that's science communication at its finest as well, isn't it? That's really something amazing. To think that somebody pops up on Twitter, it's like, posted 24 seconds ago, and like, somebody up there just posted 24 seconds ago.
I think this quote from Chris Hadfield embodies why I love him. He's talking about his feelings when William Shatner tweeted him in space. And he said it was a perfect blending of fact and fiction. And he was 7 or 8 watching Star Trek. And when he was 7 or 8 watching it, he couldn't tell the difference between reality and science fiction. And so here he was on the International Space Station. And he says, so for James Tiberius Kirk to be sending me a communique while I was living on board a space station was such a delightful crossover of fact and fantasy. And yeah, it's that boy-like love of science fiction, science, life.
And, you know, as you... tell us several times a day. Andrew, you were lucky enough to meet
Commander
Hadfield.
Yes. He was signing books before a talk he was doing at Bristol, which is Bristol's science centre. And I was incredibly fortunate to be able to interview him. And I asked him, are there any other experiences that we can have, apart from gravity? Are there any other experiences that we can have here on Earth that give us a glimpse of what it is to be an astronaut?
Oh, sure, of course. There are all sorts of books. I think the best early astronaut book that was written was by the man who orbited the moon while Neil and Buzz walked on the surface. A guy named Mike Collins wrote a book called Carrying the Fire, which is a terrific account of what it was like to be an early astronaut and what it meant. And the changes that were wrought from it. I think some of the more popular movies are fun to watch, like The Right Stuff. You know, it shows that transitional time of the very first flights and how that worked socially and technologically. But I'm also a big fan of some of the pure science fiction. I think it inspires us to think beyond the confines of our technology and our limitations of reality, and can lead then to a fearlessness of invention. I was inspired by Jules Verne and Edgar Rice Burroughs and Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury and all of those writers, H.G. Wells, in the vision of things that could possibly be and what it would be like to be a person in amongst them. And then the movie equivalents of all those as well. Planet of the Apes is really interesting. 2001, A Space Odyssey is extremely thought-provoking. And so I think trying to artistically express the realms of possibility helps to inspire people to change their reality.
You have to imagine that I'm meeting Chris Hadfield. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there across the table from him. He's signing books. I'm trying to be really cool. And then I asked him that question, and the first thing he said was, as you've just heard, is Carrying the Fire by Michael Collins, which is the best book ever written by anyone. I just love that book. And so I'm sitting there opposite Chris Hadfield. And I really wanted to dive across the table and just lunge at him and give him a massive hug. I didn't. I had to remain very cool. Mm. Well done me for not making any noises.
Well done.
I did hear a little squeak.
If you do want to know what it's like to be an astronaut, or to be one of those Apollo astronauts, and to be the first man to be on the other side of the moon from Earth on his own, then read that book. The other thing is, if you've not read any of those, or seen any of the things that he talks about, go and do it, because they're all brilliant. If they can inspire a man like him, they can inspire all of us. One of the things that Chris Hadfield did when he was up in space, of course, apart from tweeting lots of things, he posted lots of things to YouTube of really their ordinary things down here on Earth that become far from ordinary when you do them in space. One of my favourite ones is mixed nuts in space.
Oh, I have seen this.
Yeah, and it's literally just him opening a tin of mixed nuts, set to some sci-fi sounding music. It's just, it's mesmerisingly brilliant. It's about 30 seconds long or something. Absolutely fantastic. And there's actually a video which is relevant to the nitpickers of the science in gravity, which is he's done a video of what it would be like to cry in space. You wouldn't have the tears floating towards the camera. And what actually happens is that it all the tears gather in a massive weird bobble on your face, which would have looked terrible in the film.
Just wouldn't have had the same.
No, but well worth seeing. And the book that he wrote, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, is just that. What is it from an astronaut's life that ordinary people can take into theirs? He does a little pricey of it in the bit that we of the interview that we played on episode 3. It kind of goes completely against that terrible book, The Secret, where these people believe that if you believe something and think about something, that it will the universe will give it to you. The astronaut's way of doing things is that if you plan for and think about the absolute worst thing that can happen, then you can deal with it when it happens. And that's what Matt does in Gravity, and Ryan doesn't do until later.
Until later, yeah, that's the lesson that she learned.
Chris Hadfield is, of course, famous for singing in space, and I wondered if you were in space, Laura.
Yes.
Which song would you cover?
Can we just relive the Chris Hadfield moment? Can you sing to us first while I think about this?
Okay, no, but we could just, we could just have a clip from him.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on.
10,
ground control
9,
to Major Tom.
7, 6,
commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2,
detach from station and may God's love be with you.
I think we now have to review it, actually, because otherwise we can't play it.
That was marvellous.
7 out of 10. That's on a scale of people singing in space. I don't know what gets 10.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I've left forevermore. And I'm floating.
We should listen to Hulse the Planets.
But just to be clear, you're supposed to be playing it, so you're going to play the whole of the Hulse the Planets. What on?
Yeah, the viola. However, I would need you there with a triangle, and Ben, I would need you there with some cymbals for when it really kicks off in Jupiter.
I'm going to come with you on the International Space Station. And I would like to cover on my own, but I'm going to use a guitar rather than a viola.
Okay.
Do You Realise by The Flaming Lips, for obvious reasons, which are as follows. I saw them at Jodrell Bank. I think it's fair to say that that was a perfect evening in every way.
With beautiful psychedelic videos projected onto the radio telescopes.
Yeah, and Wayne Coyne and the rest of the band, you could tell they were genuinely loving the fact that they were there.
The joy that they bring to their performances, random acts of anarchy, and the sort of constant reinvention. They still have that childlike joy.
Yeah.
That Chris Hadfield has in space.
Yeah,
and I think that goes together really well.
Yeah. Ben, what would you sing if you were on the International Space Station?
When we did our previous music episode, I chose two of my favourite bands from the 90s, music that I grew up with. So I thought I'd continue that theme, and I have chosen Gravity by Drugstore.
I like what you did there. Clever.
Let's see what you did there. Funny how the stars look far away, and it makes me sad to be surrounded. There's not much else that I can do to change, but in my dreams I see you dying. The world keeps going round with the sun and the moon, and you and I are somehow in between.
Drugstore, one of those bands that really connected with me as a teenager. There's lots of good angst and lovely simple tunes, and Isabel, brilliant singer. I absolutely loved Drugstore, and then they had three great albums, and then they kind of disappeared. They were nowhere to be found. This is after they had a duet with Thom Yorke. They were doing all right in the Britpop kind of era, but completely disappeared. And then a couple of years ago, Isabel popped up with a blog, which explained where she'd been for the past 8 years.
She'd had
a really rubbish time in London. She's from Brazil. And despite having a relatively successful band, didn't do brilliantly financially, and ended up in a council estate somewhere in London, battling the council to get moved to somewhere with fewer drug dealers, a bit less violence, and a functioning environment. She wasn't in any state to make music. She was basically just surviving. So yeah, she came back with this blog, and she was writing songs again, and people donated instruments. She set up a studio. And she didn't get the whole band back together, but she got some of the musicians she used to work with, and made a new album. And now she's gigging. I saw her live a couple of years ago. So in terms of a rebirth, I think it's a great story. We are hopelessly waiting for the sky to fall down. I put my Gravity, the song, is beautiful, and it's the first song I learned to play on guitar.
Oh, very badly,
and I still play it very badly.
Quite apart from our nonsense, we had...
Yeah, you're not going to hear us sing.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Yeah. We had Hattie Briggs come to the shed, and we asked her that question too.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, also on the faces of people going by. And I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? But they're really saying, I love you. Babies crying, and I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
My name's Hattie Briggs. I'm a singer-songwriter from Stroud in Gloucestershire, and I'm just about to release my debut album on the 6th of April. And it's called Red and Gold.
Welcome to the Cosmic Shed.
Thank you very much. I like your little solar system here.
What made you choose music?
I was doing a Russian degree, got a year and a term into it, and I'd be writing a song all day rather than my essay, and thought, well, this isn't really working, so... Yeah.
Writing a song in Russian?
No, no. Russian wasn't always an obvious choice, so...
I imagine the Russians will be calling you up soon. Be there,
the new Chris Hadfield.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I've read his book. I read it last year, and I was completely inspired by it, actually. I just thought it was pretty amazing how he kind of did everything against the odds.
Yeah.
Even though he still thought he'd had virtually no chance of getting to where he wanted to be, he still did all the preparation and then somehow got there in the end. Kind of makes you think you can do anything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's one of those things as well, like if you work hard and you really want to do something, then... you can do it.
So you've got a new album coming out.
Yes.
And we'd love to hear something from that, if that's okay.
Of course. This song is called A Beautiful Mind.
Oh.
And nothing to do with the film.
Oh.
And it is about Pete Seeger. He influenced a whole generation of musicians, people like Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, and everyone that is anyone, he's sort of indirectly influenced them. And, you know, it sort of passes along the line. He died just before the Folk Awards last year, and then his half-sister Peggy Seeger, who's also a musician, she got up and spoke about him at the Folk Awards, and one of the things that she said, that Pete used to say, was that he didn't write the songs, he only wrote them down. And that was kind of what got me thinking. They say you are the one they call the wordsmith. They say the songs you only wrote them down. I heard you suffered for your fortune. I heard it never dragged you down. You had a beautiful mind. You had a beautiful face. You had a way of talking, man, that no word went to waste. They say your notebook stayed open. They
They say your heart never closed. I see the walls that you kicked over. The man behind I'll never know. You had a beautiful mind. You had a beautiful face. You had a way of talking, man, that no word went to waste. No word went to waste. Oh, oh, oh.
Thank you very much, Hattie Briggs. What an incredible thing that is. Mm. We need to do that more. We all know what Chris Hadfield has done, but I thought it would be quite interesting to know what he's going to do next.
When you have a moment where you're not doing too much, then you should be preparing for the next most important event of your life. To be a little less prosaic, I'm teaching at the University of Waterloo, so I'm a professor there. There will be more books, I'm sure. We'll write some more books. I want to get back into skiing and maybe be a part-time ski instructor, at least a ski patrol again. I need to exercise more, and I need to get back into a regular exercise cycle. I'm on the Canadian Space Advisory Board to the government and the Canadian Space Agency, and I want to help lend my voice to shaping Canadian policy. Can I help lend my particular notoriety to help people change their decision-making at the individual level, because the government is not going to take a lead where the people are not willing to support it. And if we want to actually change how we are polluting the world, then we need to, at the user level, want that change. I'm writing a lot of music. My first book is being made into a television show on ABC, a sitcom in the U.S., so that's a bunch of work. I perform music that I wrote on the space station with symphonies in Canada, and so that whole series is getting put together. I've only done it with one symphony so far.
Yeah, I'd love to see him perform with an orchestra. But the key thing there, I thought, was they're making a sitcom out of his life.
Yeah, how's that going to work?
Well, I don't know how it can.
Well, it depends who they're going to get to play him, really.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, who were they going to get to play him? That's a good question. Ooh. Who would you have?
Well, it's an obvious choice, really. Canadian space traveller, ruggedly handsome, natural leader, charisma. It's got to be Nathan Fillion.
Oh, it has to be.
Captain Malcolm Reynolds himself.
Oh, Firefly.
I would watch that.
I did think about that, and I thought, well, if they can make a sitcom out of Chris Hadfield's life, what other film, TV series, whatever, could be made out of other astronauts? Ben?
As I first saw Gravity in South Korea, I have chosen the first, I think today, only South Korean astronaut, which was Lee So-yeon. She was originally not picked to be South Korea's first astronaut. There were two women who were kind of in the running. The other person got picked and went through to the training. However, the other person was eventually disqualified for kind of shenanigans during the training.
Shenanigans!
She went to Russia for the training, for the cosmonaut training, and sent confidential material back to South Korea from the training. And this was discovered, so she was bounced out of the program. So Lee So-yeon took over, and she became quite a celebrity in South Korea. She took up kimchi with her into space to see what happens to kimchi in zero gravity, microgravity. So yeah, I just thought that story of her almost getting the gig and then being disappointed and then sort of coming back at the last minute, this kind of stuff, and the rivalry between the two women, that could make quite an interesting, light-hearted film. South Korean cinema, there's a lot of very gritty, hard-hitting films like Old Boy. There's a lot of dark horror and thrillers, but they also have a big line in comedy, probably in production right now. She's actually resigned from the Korean space program, taking the whole program with her, apparently, quite recently. So again, you know,
she resigned to make a film.
Yeah, she probably is. She's probably having a K-pop career or a film career right now. Yeah.
Laura?
Okay, so I played it safe and I wanted an Apollo 13, but I wanted a theatrical version.
Uh-huh.
And I thought this was a really nice idea. Yeah. And so doing a bit of research earlier, came across there's actually been one released. Oh. So somebody took my idea before it was conceived. In 2008, there was an interactive theatrical show titled Apollo 13 Mission Control, premiered in Wellington, New Zealand.
Well, and that's the only reason I didn't see it.
That's the only reason, yep.
Interactive.
The production faithfully recreated the mission control consoles and audience members became a part of the storyline. The show also featured a guest astronaut each night. A member of the public who suited up and amongst other duties stirred the oxygen tanks and said the line, "Houston, we've had a problem." Moving on from that, I thought, why not think of something that would be so terrible that it would be good? So I thought of maybe a musical called The Race to Space and be like a kind of West Side Story kind of take.
Brilliant!
The West Side Story take. Basically, you know, a lot of clicking of fingers and we're going to get to space before you and a lot of jazz hands. It would be a tragic love story.
Star-crossed lovers.
Star-crossed, I like it. And it would be a roller coaster of
with the music by Ronan Keating.
Ronan Keating. It would be tragically good.
Or you two, they need to follow up.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. They need to find
that was a rip-roaring success, wasn't it?
Amazing.
Spider-Man.
Andrew, do you have one?
Yes, I do, actually. I was going to base it on the life of Valentina Tereshkova, the fifth Russian cosmonaut to go into Earth's orbit, and the first woman in space. She seemed to me to be a good subject for a really turgid 3 or 4 hour long Russian film, really lacking in dialogue, just lots of browns, and really only two colours apart from brown, white, snow,
vodka,
and black space, and white stars. So Valentina Tereshkova was a chosen, really, to be the cosmonaut, because she was from such a good propaganda-friendly background. She was a textile worker in a factory, and her dad was a war hero. So perfect for communist state to project her to the world as, look, we just send our people into space, and you could all be like her. Yeah, she's now actually in the Russian government. She's still around. She said on her 70th birthday she was invited to Vladimir Putin's house, and she said while she was there, and I don't know if it's because she was in Vladimir Putin's house that she said this, but she said she'd like to go on a one-way mission to Mars. And I thought that would be quite a good place for the film to start, with her blasting off to Mars as a 70-year-old, and then sort of go back to her sitting in the textile factory and just saying to her boss something like, "Davaitye poyedem v kosmos."
Are you actually quoting from the real film? Is this something that's already been made?
Are you actually fluent?
Is this a lost Tarkovsky classic from the 70s? What did you just say?
I said, oh, sorry. So, what? Don't you speak Russian? I said, let's go to space in Russian. I could do some more dialogue from the film if you like.
Yes.
Go for
okay.
it.
She could also say this. Я хотел бы с парашютом на выходной. I like to go parachuting at the weekends. Valentina Tereshkova was a keen parachutist, one of the reasons she was chosen for the space programme at the time. And her mission was the Vostok 6 mission, which was going to be, or intended to be, the first rendezvous of craft in space. They didn't quite manage it, but yeah, she orbited the Earth several times. She was up in space for 3 days, absolutely brilliant stuff. And she's had a great life since in the Russian government, which I imagine is a good place to be in Russia. But I think the key thing with this film is the slowness of it.
Yeah.
The sparse dialogue.
Yeah.
The brown, the white and the black. I'd like to call it До свидания, лето, два. Which means goodbye, summer, two.
That sounds like that'd be a great companion to Solaris and
yeah,
Stalker.
But Solaris is a bit lively and colourful for this. You need to
right.
Much
it's a bit raunchy
slower.
At times.
Yeah, and too short.
Right.
So we need much longer. Yeah, you're getting it, though. I think you're getting it. Well,
yeah.
Yeah. What do you think? Should we make it?
Terrific. Well, maybe we should put it out to the listeners, which
that's a good idea.
Cultural thing we should move forward with. With the enormous Cosmic Shed budget.
Anyway, that's enough of that silliness. Thank you very much to Chris Hadfield. Thanks again to Peggy and Slow Brew Club for supporting us. Thank you very much again to Hattie. You can follow her on Twitter at Hattie Briggs, which is HATTIEBRIGGS, or Hattie Briggs Music on Facebook. And if you want to find out about us, more about us, you can
find us on Twitter at The Cosmic Shed.
Visit our website, thecosmicshed.com.
Find us on Facebook.
Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or other podcast platforms.
You can write to us.
The Cosmic Shed at soundofscience.co.uk.
Thank you to Houston in the Blind.
And thank you for listening. Goodbye.
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 The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. And I went to see it. No, that's a completely needless sentence. And
did you?
Yeah.
How did you travel to
the city? Did you get the bus?
Metrolink in Manchester.
Locally known as the Manchester Soyuz.
oh God, what am I going to say?
Is that right?
That's good work, Ben.
Hunas Karan.
The first bit of pronunciation trouble of this episode of The Cosmic
I'm really sorry. Huron.
Handled well by Ben Calburn.
You bastard. You bastard. And according...
Sorry.
On the subject of roller coasters, the film always makes me think of the Ronan Keating classic, Life is a Roller Coaster. If you can imagine, as Ryan Stone, Sandra Bullock is re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, if you can just imagine Ronan singing, "Life is a roller coaster, just got to ride it, ride it, ride it."
Can we
it.
Be your backing dancers? All right.
Then that would be a better film, but it didn't happen.
No.
Sadly,
disappointing.
That bit isn't going in the podcast. Mm. I hope.